Hey, hey, hey. Welcome back to the last episode of our true crime series, Killer Couple Edition. If you have not listened to our fourth episode of this series, No Remorse, it's available on Spotify and Apple. But as usual, grab yourself a drink and a snack. Go ahead and get comfortable.
And let's get into it.
Oh my God.
All right, before we dive into the cases, I'm going to give you guys the trigger warning. This episode deals with violent, gruesome, and triggering events, including sexual assault, animal abuse, murder, and more, that may not be suitable for all listeners. The information for this podcast episode is based off extensive research done by both of us. We at Cosign Podcast do not intend any disrespect to the victims or their family members involved in these crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
So this week, I'm going to be telling you guys about Jeremy Steink and Jasmine Richardson. So we're going to start with Jasmine and how they met. So before Jasmine met Jeremy, she was described as a happy social girl, and she was also a Catholic school honor student. Jasmine was only 11 years old when she first met Jeremy at a punk rock show, and only 12 years old when they started officially dating. Jeremy was 23 at the time. It's said that both were members of the website VampireFreaks.com, which is a goth social network, and they regularly communicated here. Jasmine's network name tag on the site was Runaway Devil, and Jeremy's was Soul Eater. The couple were also found to be communicating on Nexopia, which is a popular website for young Canadians. Multiple messages they sent to each other were actually available to the public for a time before the accounts were removed completely by Nexopia staff. Jasmine was instantly taken with the goth lifestyle and would wear dark makeup to make her look much older than she was, even claiming on her Vampire Freaks page that she was 15 instead of 12. She started wearing all dark clothes, fishnets, and mesh, and was regularly chasing what her parents considered to be older, unsuitable men. Jeremy, on the other hand, is also from Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada, and his own upbringing wasn't as wholesome as Jasmine's was. His mother was an alcoholic, and her boyfriend abused Jeremy regularly. Kids at school bullied him, and by the time he had met Jasmine, he had already attempted suicide. From the age of 13, Jeremy had developed an elaborate persona. He allegedly told friends at school that he liked the taste of blood and wore a vial with real blood in it around his neck. He also claimed to people that he was a 300-year-old werewolf and was a poor high school dropout. Jasmine's parents got wind of the relationship between the two by monitoring her web chats. They grounded her and told her she was not allowed to see him. Her friends later told police that her parents thought he was a pedophile, but Jasmine still managed to regularly sneak out and see him. He found ways to slip her notes via email saying, "You are a sight for sore eyes, and I miss you more than killing people. Can we get together and kill people together?" End quote. After her parents came across these messages, they took away the computer and started making her go to family counseling. Soon, Jasmine seemed to be calming down, so they gave her the computer back but warned her to stay away from Jeremy. But Jasmine and Jeremy were in love. Livid at Jasmine's parents, Jeremy wrote on his blogging platform on April 3rd, 2006, "Payment. My lover's rents are totally unfair. They say that they really care. They don't know what is going on, they just assume. Their throats I want to slit. Finally, there shall be silence. Their blood shall be payment." End quote. However, according to police reports, it was Jasmine who first proposed the plan to kill her family. In an email, she told Jeremy she had a plan, saying, "It begins with me killing them and ends with me living with you." Jeremy was receptive to the idea, replying, "Well, I love your plan, but we need to get a little more creative with, like, the details and stuff." Jasmine reportedly told friends about their plans to kill her parents, but her friends thought she was joking. Jeremy also told friends he wanted to follow through with their plan, but without sparing her little brother Jacob, which Jasmine originally wanted to do. The night before the murders, the couple watched Oliver Stone's 1994 film Natural Born Killers, which is partly based around the deadly road trip killing spree of Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate. And if you guys don't remember, Mackenzie covered that case in one of our other episodes of this series, so definitely check that out because it is a crazy one. So then on April 23rd, 2006, at her parents' home on a quiet residential street in Medicine Hat, Jasmine and Jeremy followed through with their plan. Jeremy took the lead, stabbing her mom, Deborah, several times before moving to her dad, Mark, and doing the same. A screwdriver was also found at the scene, and investigators concluded that Mark had used it to try to defend himself. While he took care of his part, Jasmine executed her part of the plan and slit her little brother's throat. The next day, the neighbors contacted police when their son went over to the Richardson's house to see his best friend, who was Jasmine's 8-year-old younger brother, Jacob. However, there was no answer at the door. The boy peeked in the basement window and saw what looked like a body and ran home in terror and told his mother. When investigators arrived on scene, inside they found a bloodbath. The bodies of Deborah and Mark Richardson were in the basement. Mark had 24 stab wounds and Deborah had 12. Blood was sprayed all over the floors and walls, and upstairs they found Jacob, his throat cut, surrounded by blood-soaked toys in his bed. One investigator noticed a family photo with a picture of Jasmine and searched the house for her body, but there was no sign of her. At this time, they feared that whoever had murdered the family had also abducted the girl. But a day later, another theory emerged and the police got a tip from one of their friends. He said the couple had been at a party the night before and had boasted about killing her parents. Jeremy was quoted saying, "He gutted them like fish." Police caught the couple trying to escape town in a pickup truck being driven by their 19-year-old friend, Casey Lancaster, who was later charged with being an accessory and for disposing of evidence. They had only traveled 80 miles before they were stopped. Jasmine admitted to detectives that she was desperately unhappy at home because her parents wouldn't let her see Jeremy. In the first story she told them, she said that she came home and found her family slaughtered and said that Jeremy was the murderer. Jeremy confessed to killing Mark and Deborah, but he insisted he did not kill Jacob. She cut his throat, he said. Her story about her brother's death kept changing. First, she said Jeremy did it. Then she said that she ended Jacob's life because it was too sad to leave him as an orphan. She recalled hearing the boy gurgle as he died. Jeremy called it a love story, and at his trial in 2008, he was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to 3 life terms in prison. He'll be eligible for parole after serving only 25 years. Under the Youth Criminal Justice Act, Jasmine's name could no longer be published in Canada after she became a suspect. Under the same act, 12 is the youngest possible age at which a person can be charged with a crime. Convicts who were under 14 years of age at the time they committed a crime cannot be sentenced as adults and cannot be given more than a 10-year sentence. On July 9, 2007, Jasmine, who had by then turned 13, was found guilty of 3 counts of first-degree murder in the killings. On November 8, 2007, she was sentenced to the maximum penalty of 10 years imprisonment. Her sentence included credit for the 18 months already spent in custody, to be followed by 4 years in a psychiatric institution and 4.5 years under conditional supervision in the community. In September 2011, Jasmine began attending classes at Mount Royal University in Calgary, Alberta, during the final years of her sentence. She was released from her 10-year sentence at a psychiatric hospital in the fall of 2011, and in October 2012, it was reported her rehabilitation was going well, and she expressed remorse for her actions that experts considered to be genuine. In May 2016, her sentence was completed, and she was freed of any further court-ordered conditions, restrictions, or supervision after a final sentence review on May 6, 2016. She returned to live in a community under a brand new identity, which to this day is completely unknown. Her crime made her a footnote in history because she is believed to be the youngest Canadian ever to be convicted of multiple murders. So, before Mackenzie dives into her case, I just had 3 points that I wanted to point out here. First, I wanted to bring up the fact that this is an example of someone that had a healthy childhood versus someone who had an unhealthy childhood. And look at the severe impact the abused had on the non-abused. Another thing, I've also briefly shared in a past episode how I feel about men or women in their 20s dating adolescent girls and boys who are still developing. This case is proof that the outcome can be absolutely devastating, resulting in the child being heavily influenced by an adult that is claiming to love them. It's not right. One of my favorite quotes about this topic is this: "Sis, you're not mature for your age. He is a pedophile, and I stand by that." My third point is, it's crazy to me that even though she was a minor, that she was able to get out of prison and completely change her identity and fall off the face of the earth. I get the concept of wanting to allow someone to start over, but when someone has committed a crime as brutal as this, I don't believe it's safe for the public to not have knowledge of who she is if they come in contact with her. So you can let me know in comments or messages, DMs, any of that, how you feel about that. But I stand by all three of those things.
We're back. The only thing that comes to mind after hearing Sam's case is one word: tragic. Tragic that multiple lives were lost, taken, and ruined. And it's unfortunate that it was at the hands of someone so young and so influenced by someone that was claiming to love her. But for the final episode of our true crime series, I am bringing you guys the case of the Sunset Strip Killers. Together, the Sunset Strip Killers terrorized sex workers along the strip in Los Angeles, California, murdering them and then defiling their lifeless bodies. So let's meet Doug Clark, half of this murderous duo. Douglas Daniel Clark was born March 10th, 1948. He enjoyed a comfortable childhood as a so-called military brat. He was the son of Franklin Clark, a naval intelligence officer. His family moved quite frequently during his childhood due to his father's job, and he later claimed to have lived in 37 countries. In 1958, his father left the Navy for a civilian position as an engineer with the Transport Company of Texas, but the family still moved around. They lived in Marshall Islands for a time, moved back to San Francisco, and then moved again to India. Doug was sent to an exclusive international school in Geneva, and later attended Culver Military Academy, a prestigious prep school in Indiana, while his father continued to move around the world. Doug attempted to become a military man himself, but his disciplined military upbringing did not prevent him from engaging in troubling behavior. As a teenager, Doug Clark reportedly recorded his sexual escapades with girls at school without their knowledge. After graduating in 1967, he followed his father's footsteps and joined the Air Force, stationed in Colorado and Ohio. Doug was eventually discharged from the Air Force in 1979, and he drifted around the world for the next decade, often working as a mechanic. He moved to Los Angeles and was employed as a steam plant operator for the LA Department of Water and Power, working at the Valley Generating Station, before abruptly quitting. Afterward, Doug became a boiler operator at the Jergens Soap Factory in Burbank, but was fired due to a high rate of absences and violent threats that he had made against his co-workers. Already a rehearsed predator, he began trolling the Sunset Strip, an area of Hollywood that is notorious for its shady dealings. It was a prime spot for him to solicit sex workers and runaways, and he spent a lot of his time prowling the bars for lonely older women to seduce out of their money. Around Christmas of 1979, he walked into a bar in North Hollywood called Little Nashville, and he met Carol Bundy, an awkward 37-year-old nurse drinking alone. Honestly, Doug thought that she was easy prey, but the pair soon moved in together. Louise Farr, author of The Sunset Murders, told the LA Times that Doug Clark was very good at murmuring in women's ears in bars and getting them to sleep with him and giving him a place to stay. He was essentially a leech. And Doug may have not been as famous as Charles Manson, Ted Bundy, or Richard Ramirez, but his crimes as one half of this infamous killer couple were just as gruesome as any other serial killer. Now, let's meet Carol. Carol Bundy had a troubled childhood, as both of her parents were abusive alcoholics, and her mother died when she was young, and her father sexually abused her starting at the age of 11. After her father was remarried, he put her in various foster homes, and when Carol was only 17 years old, she married a 56-year-old man. By the time that Carol met Doug Clark at the age of 37, she had just escaped her third marriage to an abusive man by whom she had two young sons with. She had also began an affair with her apartment manager and part-time country singer, John Robert Murray, and had attempted to bribe his wife into leaving him. Robert's wife compelled him to evict Carol, but she still continued to show up regularly to the venues that he was singing. It was one of these venues, a bar called Little Nashville, where she met Doug Clark for the first time in 1980. Doug soon moved in with Carol, and they found out that they shared dark and sexual fantasies. From the get-go, it was clear that he and Carol shared more than just passion for each other. They also shared similar disturbing desires. It's obvious that Doug quickly seduced Carol and moved into her apartment with her two young sons. Doug began bringing prostitutes back to the couple's apartment to have threesomes. He then took an interest in an 11-year-old neighbor in the same complex. Together, they began to molest this little girl, photographing the abuse. Carol began to lure the little girl into posing for pornographic photos, but Doug quickly escalated from pedophilia to talking about how much he would like to kill a girl during sex. And according to Carol, Doug began to tell her his fantasies of killing people and sexual sadism. He persuaded Carol to purchase two automatic pistols for him to use, and reportedly seeking to fulfill his fantasy of killing a woman during sex, and I'm sorry for this next part, feeling her vaginal contractions during the death spasms. He killed at least three teenagers on his own, all of whom he had picked up on the Sunset Strip, and he confessed these crimes to Carol, but instead of ending the relationship and calling the police on her bloodthirsty lover, she became his accomplice. Their first victim together was a sex worker they picked up on the Strip. Carol was sitting in the back seat with her gun and claimed that she was supposed to shoot the woman, but she didn't have the nerve to do so. She handed the gun to Doug, who shot the woman in the head. Carol then undressed the woman's dead body, while Doug drove them to a gravel road off of the Hollywood Freeway, where they then disposed of it. One night in June 1980, Doug came home and told Carol about two teenagers, Gina Narano and Cynthia Chandler, whom he had murdered after picking them up on the Sunset Strip. He had ordered them to perform fellatio on him and then shot them both in the head before taking them to the garage and raping their dead bodies. He then dumped the bodies near Ventura Freeway, where they were found the next day. An uneasy Carol phoned the police, admitting to having some knowledge of the murders, but refused to provide any clues as to Doug's identity. Doug told Carol that if either of them were apprehended, he would take the blame in the hope that she would be allowed to go free. And though Doug easily committed a handful of murders on his own, Carol quickly played her own disturbing role in these killings, but this murderous spree was already beginning to unravel. 12 days after the initial murders, Doug killed two women who were working as prostitutes, Karen Jones and Exie Wilson. As before, Doug lured them into the car, shot them, and dumped their bodies in plain sight, but not before removing Exie's head. Doug took the head back to their home and stored it in the refrigerator. Upon seeing it, Carol put makeup on it before putting it back in the freezer so Doug could use it again. 2 days later, on June 23, 1980, a man spied a seemingly handmade small pine box sitting in an alley in Studio City. Curious, he lifted the lid on the box, only to discover a horrifying sight. Wrapped in a t-shirt printed with the words, "Daddy's girl," was the head of 20-year-old Exie Wilson. Her torso was later found in a dumpster in the valley. And for those of you who have never been to California, Studio City and the valley are about 15 to 20 minutes apart from each other, to give you a little reference. As the bodies from Douglas Clark's bloodlust piled up, the culprits became known as the Sunset Strip Killers. 3 days later, another victim was found in the woods in the San Fernando Valley, a runaway named Marnette Comer, and it appeared that she had been killed 3 weeks earlier, making her Doug's first known victim. The body of Karen Jones was also found behind a steakhouse in Burbank. Meanwhile, Carol Bundy continued to attend her ex's performances and afterwards would make conversation with him. After a few drinks, the conversation turned to things that she and Doug were doing. Robert was obviously alarmed and implied that he might tell the police. And to prevent this from happening, in August of 1980, Carol lured him back to his van after a show, offering to have sex with him. And once they were inside, she shot and decapitated him and brought his head back home to Doug. Carol left various clues behind, including shell casings in the van. And allegedly, when Carol called and told Doug that she was bringing Robert's head home, he grew very angry and made her clarify that it was only the head that she was bringing home. The couple threw the head away in the trash can. It was never found. Robert's body was discovered on August 9th in a residential area after neighbors complained of the smell coming from his van. 2 days later, Carol soon bowed to psychological pressure and confessed to her coworkers that she had killed her ex and taken lives, saying, "I meant to be saving lives, not taking them." They called the police and she gave a full confession to her and Doug's crimes. Doug is actually believed to have murdered an unidentified youth whose body was discovered on August 26, 1981 in Newhall, California. The victim had been shot in the head and was found wearing only a red sweatshirt. Her face was reconstructed by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children in efforts to identify her because her remains were so unrecognizable due to skeletonization. Their murder weapons were found hidden in Doug's workplace after his arrest, and Doug was charged with 6 murders. At his trial, he acted as his own defense counsel and maintained his innocence, claiming that Carol and her ex, Robert, were actually the real murderers and that he was being framed and manipulated. The jury did not believe him. Carol did not testify for the prosecution at Doug's trial, but did testify for the defense, having been granted immunity from prosecution for additional crimes. Doug was convicted of all 6 murders and sentenced to death in 1983. As of 2021, Doug was still sitting on California's death row in San Quentin State Prison. Now, some doubt has actually been casted on the nature of Doug Clark's conviction. Criminologist Christopher Barry D. has actually challenged that Doug could provide alibis for 5 of the 6 murders that he was convicted of, and that the presiding judge refused to accept key physical evidence, including a witness and several banking documents that exonerated Doug in the XC Wilson murder. Carol's testimony was proven to be highly inconsistent. She claimed at first that Doug had murdered Jane Doe 18 2 weeks before her interview on August 11th without her involvement or knowledge. When she was told that Doug had an alibi for that date, she was allowed to change her story and subsequently provided intricate details on the manner of the murder and location of the body, even though she had initially claimed to know nothing about it. Carol also alleged that police allowed her to withdraw $3,000 from her ex's bank account, although she claims that the police took the money. Carol was charged with 2 murders, John Robert Murray and the unidentified victim, the murder that she confessed to witnessing after she handed Doug the gun. Carol was sentenced to a prison term of 25 years for Murray's murder and the term of 27 years for the second murder. On May 2nd, 1983, Carol pleaded guilty to killing John Robert Murray and handing the gun to Doug to kill the unknown sex worker. In her plea, she called herself a reluctant partner who had been in the hands of a maniac who overwhelmed her. And according to Carol herself, I quote, "It was a fantasy that just got badly out of control." However, to journalist Mark McNamara, who interviewed her in jail, Carol was far from an innocent victim. He quotes, "Carol Bundy seemed motivated by true sociopathology, as well as a desire to manipulate people. She would not talk to me unless I bought her a typewriter," he told the Daily Mirror. "She wanted respect, and Carol was colder, darker, less sympathetic, more cowardly, yet more refined and perhaps more clever." Carol died in prison from heart failure on December 9th, 2003, at the age of 61. Doug Clark was found equally disturbing. "He wanted attention," Louise Farr told the New York Post. "When he was in county jail, there were a lot of serial killers inside. The Hillside Strangler, for example. And Doug was so pissed because he wasn't getting as much of attention as the other serial killers." Louise said her interaction with both killers was chilling. I had a terrible time sleeping afterward. I made the mistake of spending too long of a time with Doug and Carol. I would spend several hours. They are manipulators. They manipulate all the time. After you leave, you have the feeling that something's been done to you. To this day, it's unclear who seduced who to kick off the couple's murderous spree, but it is wildly believed that Doug's homicidal impulses led him to kill his own victims first and then convincing Carol to join him later. I'm going to end this case with this quote. "I don't think I'll ever live long enough to get out of here, but you get by. I've always been a very zen person." Doug Clark was quoted in saying this in an article about prison's death row inmates. And that is all I have on Doug Clark and Carol Bundy, the Sunset Strip Killers.
That is all we have for not only this week's episode, but also our true crime series and season 2. We hope you guys enjoyed this season as much as we did, and we're looking forward to taking a little time off to prepare and prep for the launch of season 3 with some brand new ideas and material coming your way. We're going to also be adding questions and polls to our social medias in the upcoming weeks to get some feedback on some future topics we're planning to discuss, so definitely be on the lookout for those. And if you think of any topics regarding relationships, self-development, or mental health that you would like us to discuss, go follow and shoot us a DM on Instagram at co.signpodcast and click the link in our bio to rate and review us on Apple. And as always, we will see you guys on the other side.
Bye!
Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh my god.